The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private Network.
On News Talk.
Corrosive politics, rising inflation, food prices, a looming recession all make for a pessimistic outlook for America. The Democrats promised a new dawn for the United States when Joe Biden was inaugurated in January of 2021. But instead of seeing ideological divides shrink, they've actually widened. Joe Biden's promise to reach across the aisle based on decades of experience of congressional politics were rebuffed. Issues like abortion, gun control, and the power of the Supreme Court have become more polarizing than ever before. So here to unravel the complex nuances of American politics, Harry Brown, senior media lecturer at TUD, and Larry Donnelly, NUI Galway Law Lecturer and political columnist. Good morning and welcome to you both. Now, I have to say that I'm pretty dismayed and depressed about what's happening to America. And I'm wondering, do you gentlemen share my pessimism, Harry?
I certainly do, Pat. Yeah, I was in the States in June, early July, visiting family, and the sense of kind of warring cultures, warring factions, and never the twain shall meet is beyond anything that I've ever seen. I remember back in the 90s, my mother married a guy who was a Republican voter. And
Is that unthinkable?
It's unthinkable now. Yeah. And it was really, and he's not a Republican voter anymore, of course, now, because it would have been almost hard to imagine them staying together in this America. I've had family members talking about where their kids are going to college and making sure that the flights will only be through blue states. So that, and I think that to a certain extent, COVID accentuated some of those kind of cultural warrior differences. But the sense of crisis in America, I think, has been more or less nonstop for the last 10 or 15 years. And
Larry, are you as pessimistic?
I'm pessimistic. I'm scared, but at the end of the day, I still hold out hope. I mean, I think that some of the trends that Harry had pointed to, you know, look, Donald Trump would never have been elected president of the United States if America wasn't in a very difficult position. There's no doubt about that. There's all sorts of factors that account for that. In my view, the principal ones are technology and globalization, as well as the collective complexion of the United States darkening in color. Those two things have had a huge impact on American society. But I do have to say, in terms of the political divide, my group of friends, you know, are pretty evenly, I suppose, split between Democrat and Republican, Trump supporters, Trump loathers. We're still great pals. We can put that all aside and have a good old chat about everything. And at the end of the day, more still unites us than divides us.
The American experiment, and it's hundreds of years old now. I mean, the Constitution does not seem to serve the intentions of that experiment anymore. The idea that you've got 50 states and 100 senators, irrespective of the population of those states, just seems anti-democratic and wrong.
Well, to some, it may. And I mean, here's where I would break with my party, and I'm sure I'd break with Harry on this one. The reality is the United States is, it's a compromise. I mean, there are powers at state level. There are powers at national level. The United States Senate is a compromise. You know, just like the House of Representatives is based on population, you have a certain number of Congress people based on population. The Senate was a compromise to achieve that balance between different states. And what I would say to people is that who say it's axiomatic, we need to have more senators from California than from Wyoming or whatever it might be. If you think the United States is divided right now, you try and dilute. It's not going to happen for all sorts of reasons, but you try to dilute the power of states that are now referred to commonly as flyover territory. You're looking potentially at secession movements very, very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I don't disagree with Larry on that, except I would add that the compromise was born out of a lot of the contradictions that were inherent in the foundation of the United States.
Racism, slavery, etc. You know, yeah. We are subject to the same sort of thing in the EU, where our Taoiseach, with a population of 5 million people, will have a vote equal to a German chancellor with a population of 70 million people,
it is. And we don't, the Germans don't jump up and down about Ireland having too much influence in the EU because they understand it's a compromise. They do occasionally, of course. But
hasn't it come to a crisis point now? Where you have, for example, every Democratic president or every Democratic candidate has had a majority, but not every Democratic candidate has won the presidential election. So
there is a constitutional problem there, Pat. Yeah, I mean, Republicans constantly lose the popular vote, but they get quite a few shots at the White House. There's no question that there's a problem. I think the problem that we're experiencing now has a lot to do with the financial crisis of 2008. I think that the Tea Party movement that came out of that crisis that has essentially taken over the Republican Party with a kind, you know, with an initial you know, correct diagnosis. The system is rigged. But the system is rigged turns into a series of conspiracy theories about electoral fraud, about, you know, a globalist plot to darken America and to take over the country on behalf of the New World Order, etc. And I think that that, you know, that phenomenon of the wrong answer to the right question is really, to a certain extent, where America has found itself lost.
Yeah, I think Harry's absolutely right in that. I think one of the key points to make here is American conservatism has changed dramatically from what it once was. If you look at the Ronald Reagan type of conservatism in the 1980s, it was something very different to the Trumpian conservatism that exists now. The conservatism that exists now is not pure ideological conservatism as we always knew it. Instead, it is turn back the clock conservatism. Let's make things like they were back in the 1950s after the Second World War. Let's turn back the clock. Let's you know, we don't like the way that the, again, minorities or the minority populations on the rise. We don't like the fact that you can't get a good job out of high school anymore and have a good life and livelihood. We want to turn back the clock. We want to push back against all these trends. That's what conservatism is about in the United States right now. And as I've said a number of times, to the dismay of a lot of people in Ireland, I think, regrettably, for lots of reasons, that's a winning formula by and large for the Republican Party. It's certainly a vastly better, I suppose, recipe than what was on offer from the likes of John McCain and Mitt Romney.
It is, of course, delusional as well, because you can't turn back the clock. And I would just add to that that I think what I saw in the States when I was there last time was a lot of sort of delusion on the liberal side as well and on the Democratic side. People obsessed with getting Trump. You know, the January 6th hearings were kind of at their height when I was there. And people were interrupting conversations about the Supreme Court, about the gun problem, to talk about the latest shocking revelations from the January 6th hearings. And it's just that kind of delusional thinking that you can somehow defeat the right by getting them all arrested seems to me to be just as problematic.
What do you do about a situation that, I mean, the bizarre thing that Donald Trump, of all people, should be the darling of people who want to go back to the 50s? I mean, even he...
Studio 54, more like.
Right? He might have been a Democrat. He probably was.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at his conversions on issues like abortion and different things, I mean, Donald Trump was in a total different place if you go back 30 years ago. It is remarkable, Pat, the fact that Donald Trump has somehow become this almost working class hero for lots of dispossessed people in the United States. It's nothing short of extraordinary. And there's another element to that. And that is, I suppose, the corrosion in the media, corrosion in popular culture in the United States, such that politics has merely become almost another form of entertainment. And certainly Donald Trump rode the crest of that wave all the way to the White House. People are sick of buttoned-up politicians saying the same things. They said, look, we want to throw the whole system out. We want somebody brand new. Now, in my view, the people who decide these elections, the people who took a punt on Donald Trump, for instance, I think that they've soured. I think that the majority of Americans have had enough of Donald Trump. I do not think he could be elected president again, but he still commands a lot of loyalty, commands a huge presence within the Republican Party.
And then you have the Supreme Court, where by a complete accident of health or ill health, a particular president gets to select any number of Supreme Court judges. Yeah. And we know what the result is in the case of Donald Trump.
Yeah, three for Trump. And that has been absolutely decisive and may be decisive for decades to come. It's extraordinary.
Now, what is the impact of that going to be? I mean, can actions by one man, President Donald Trump, in selecting three Supreme Court justices impact the generality of the federation of states that is America? Or, such as your constitution, can the states just do their own thing anyway, leaving some people dispossessed of rights and other people enjoying rights?
Yeah, you have the states. I mean, the Supreme Court decisions in some cases, like the abortion case, have been throw it back to the states, let the states do their own thing. And that, of course, kind of heightens this sense of the difference between the red states and the blue states. But then in other situations, you have the Supreme Court saying that, for instance, New York can't have a law against concealed carry for weapons. So the Supreme Court is a problem. The Biden administration certainly is much too timid to know anything to do about it. I mean, we had the leak of this Dobbs decision, the one that overturns Roe v. Wade. We had the leak of that a couple of months in advance of the decision actually dropping. And yet when it came, the administration really had nothing to say, nothing to do, is not prepared to take on the power of the court. And I think that that's a mistake. I think that, you know, America is in a mood to elect people like Donald Trump. And I would actually say before Trump, the mood to elect Barack Obama was itself, I think, a sign that America was ready for change and ready for something quite different. That America, I think, would be ready for a president that was able and willing to take on the power of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think Harry's right on many fronts. I mean, just to put forward the argument being made by this court, the court would say effectively, some people are saying the court is exerting too much power. The court would say, the majority of the court would say, it's actually removing itself from issues like abortion and other things. That it's saying, look, these are matters that belong in the political realm, not the judicial or constitutional realm. You are free. Every state is free to come up with whatever legislation it wants on that topic. Now, on the gun issue, I think there's an inherent contradiction there. But what the court would say is that unlike this right to privacy, which is mentioned nowhere in the text of the United States Constitution, the right to bear arms is explicitly mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. That would be the argument that they follow. But in an overarching sense, they would say these matters are being kicked back to the states and they're being kicked back to politicians. And that's where, in my view, people on the left are going to have to mobilize. They're going to have to mobilize in the political arena.
Perhaps you'd explain to our listeners the difference in the way the Constitution of the United States is interpreted and the way in which the Irish Constitution is interpreted. We're always told that this document, you know, a 1937 Constitution with a few amendments along the way, is meant to be interpreted in the light of its own time, not of the time of its writing, but the time of its interpretation. In other words, today. And the American Constitution, at a time of militias and all the rest of it, the right to bear arms, and, you know, you're thinking of the Wild West and the very survival of people on the frontier, it might have been important to have a gun. It is not necessarily important to have, or shouldn't be important to have a gun going to church on a Sunday.
Yeah, well, there are a whole slew of differences between the two constitutions that, in my view, whatever you think about the results that come out, which in my view render the conservatives on the court, how they interpret it, to be defensible. The reality is the Irish Constitution contains vastly more substantive rights than the United States Constitution does. The Irish Constitution also explicitly provides for the right to judicial review and says certain things cannot be taken away from the purview of the courts. The American Constitution is vastly different. It's far more concerned with process, with procedure, than with any substance. And in terms of the role of the judiciary, the United States Constitution allocates very little to the judiciary. And I'll put it to you this way, Pat. There is only one constitutional court in the United States, the United States Supreme Court. And its jurisdiction is limited to a small number of things. And the U.S. Constitution specifically says that Congress can take away all of the courts appellate jurisdiction tomorrow if it wanted to. It can also eliminate every other federal court in the country if it wanted to tomorrow. So given the design, the Constitution design, like it or not, the United States federal judiciary is far less empowered than the Irish judiciary.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer from a law lecturer, and I don't have too much to add on the Constitution. But again, historically, just to say that one of the things that was certainly, I think the recent historiography has pointed out that slave patrols, as much as the Wild West, the need to be able to capture fleeing slaves with armed militias was very important in the original Second Amendment.
But that's what I'm saying about what the intent was at the time and what the reality is today.
And the United States has been extremely hesitant to amend the Constitution in a way. I mean, we amend the Constitution every time Europe wants to make a new treaty here in Ireland. But in the United States, I remember I grew up with the campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment for gender equality in the 1970s, and it failed. You know, I mean, a pretty straightforward statement for the United States Constitution to say women are equal to men, and it wasn't able to get through the process to amend the Constitution.
Now, politics being broken, and we've talked about the ideological differences that separate people, and often the suspicion is these are not deeply held beliefs at all. They are populist beliefs feeding the constituent electorates, and that's why these politicians espouse those particular beliefs. But to get elected, even at a lower level, maybe to the state legislature, never mind to Washington, requires such an amount of money. Mm-hmm. And they will happily say in the NFL, a football team can only spend so much on players every year, but there's no limit to the amount of money that politicians can raise in their own ends.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's down in large part, again, to a decision from the United States Supreme Court in the 1970s, which held that money in the context of political donations is the equivalent of free speech. Then we've had subsequent decisions which effectively have said that you can pour corporations and anyone who wants to can pour unlimited cash into political campaigns. And make no mistake, I mean, the United States is a two-party system. When you think of that objectively, a country of 350 million people, diverse in every conceivable way, you have two political parties. That's crazy. But at least in the old days, those parties were bigger tents. They included moderates who deviated from the party line. So there was an ability to do deals and get things done. In American politics, there's no money in nuance. There's no money in moderation. So what you have is money that is pulling candidates, Republicans well to the right, Democrats well to the left. The center has been hollowed out. And then you have another force at play, which is gerrymandering of congressional districts, which has made a lot of districts very, very red, a lot of districts very, very blue. So again, moderation in no sense pays off for an aspiring politician.
I would argue that the Democrats haven't really been pulled to the left in any substantial way. Indeed, Biden represents the classic moderate Democrat, and I think that, you know, the failure of his administration is indicative of the failure of the moderate Democrat. We had in 2020 Bernie Sanders winning the Nevada caucuses with a classic union, multiracial coalition of working class voters, and the Democratic Party establishment came down like a ton of bricks on that movement to make sure that Bernie wasn't going to get the nomination.
I would just push back slightly because I absolutely agree with the point that you're making in a sense, Harry. What I'm saying is that the Democratic Party has been pulled away from its roots. And I shouldn't necessarily say that's left. It's been pulled away from its roots in the sense that on the one hand, people of faith, people who might be socially conservative, would have been comfortable in the Democratic Party. It has moved way to the left on cultural issues. At the same time, it is because of the money race, it has adopted a corporatist agenda and in many ways abandoned the people who work with their hands for a living and live paycheck to paycheck in favor of a corporatist agenda on things like free trade, et cetera. So the Democratic Party, because of money, has strayed well away from its roots to the point that now it's a party for cultural leftists and wealthy college graduates.
So that's the question for the Democrats. I mean, are they too woke? Are they too out of touch? You know, as you say, the blue collar worker who lives paycheck to paycheck, does he, you know, he doesn't want to be a Trumper. Or does he?
A lot of them do, because what Trump did, and this is why I say it was politically advantageous, what Trump did was he wedded the social conservatism with an economic message that's very, very at odds with Republican orthodoxy. But, you know, historically, Trump really is almost the second coming of Pat Buchanan in many ways because of his politics. That's social conservatism, yet anti-free trade, let's turn back the clock, that sort of thing. That is very, very appealing to white blue-collar workers in the United States. And there's another element to it, too, which I keep hopping on about and will continue to do so, is the drift of Latino Americans to the Republican Party and to Trump's message and to conservatism. It is the biggest story in American politics at present, and yet the most ignored story is the Democratic Party's abject failure to reach out to Latinos and to take them for granted on the assumption that they would be just like African Americans. They thought that demographics would be destiny. Things are moving in a very different direction.
So why are the Latinos going in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think Larry's making the point that that blue-collar worker that you're talking about is living paycheck to paycheck is very likely
is
to be a brown woman.
You know? The Catholicism of the Latino population?
There are a few factors.
There are a few factors, and they include what Larry's talking about, the Democrats' kind of donor orientation instead of a class orientation. I mean, as I've suggested earlier, it is certainly possible to make a coalition of working class brown, black and white people behind a Democrat candidate. I think at times the Sanders campaign indicated mm-hmm. that. And the Democratic establishment doesn't want that. They think that the suburban white college-educated voter is more likely to come out and more likely to be decisive in elections than those brown and black and white working-class voters. And that is a fundamental problem. But I think that the answer to that can't be to turn your back on immigrants, for example, which I think is too often what the kind of conservative Democrat who says we need to do something to deal with the Trump phenomenon says, but we need to be anti-immigration. I think that can't be the answer.
Is there a place now for a third party? I mean, you talk about the moderates of the Republican Party, the John McCains, the late John McCain.
Yeah, they're dead.
Currently Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, that faction of the party, those Republicans who wouldn't run again because they knew they would be out-trumped by Trump candidates in the primaries. the kind of people who want, you know, a college education for their kids and are prepared to tax for it to make sure it's available and affordable. So take the middle ground of the Republicans, the middle ground of the Democrats. Is there space for a third party, or is it too red and blue?
There's absolutely space for it, and I find it absolutely fascinating discussion to have. But I'm dispirited, and I often just end the discussion on this, is that the stranglehold that the Republican and Democratic parties, to their mutual advantage, have on the process and have on the system means that we can talk all day long, but I'm very, very dubious about any change.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I would also argue that the space is not in the center. I think that a reconfiguration of the spectrum is actually what's needed. And I think I would say this, I think the space is on the left.
So finally, you know, we started talking about pessimism, if not quite despair, for the American system. But there's no doubt, looking at what America has become in terms of guns, in terms of divisive politics, corrosive politics, it's not the America that many young Irish people growing up aspired to. It's not the ideal that we once worshipped and admired.
It's in decline. There's no question about it. You only have to go on the streets of American cities and see still closed up businesses and see the state of the roads and the highways. It's a country that has not looked after itself properly, that has decided that its interest was to pour money into a military industrial complex, pour money into the technology sector, and not look after the basic fabric of people's everyday lives. I find it a very sad place. And I think the politics that we're talking about are symptomatic of that deeper crisis of decline.
I'm afraid I agree with a lot of what Harry said. I still hold out hope. But if I will say one thing, if we can't turn back the clock, the biggest scandal in America, in my view, is the cost of third level education, because that is the way out for people who are disadvantaged. And the fact that the cost is so staggering is just disgusting at every level. And it makes me sick sometimes when I hear people continue to say that America is the land of opportunity when attending a good college or university will break the bank financially and leave people in debt for their whole lives.
On that pessimistic note, Larry Donnelly, NUI Galway Law Lecturer, Political Columnist, and Harry Brown, Senior Lecturer for Media at TUD, thank you both very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.